2014. This is the Hermetic Hour, and I am your host, Polk Runyon. Now, tonight, we're going to have as a very special guest speaker, Joe Carson, the leader of Feriferia, and she will talk to us about Eleusis and the mysteries of death and rebirth, and what happens to the soul after death, and what can be expected in the afterlife. Now, Joe is the, she likes to call herself the leader of Feriferia. I refer to her as the avatrix of Feriferia, as more spiritual. Joe has written a new book, Celebrate Wilderness, Magic, Birth, and Love on the Feriferian Path, which includes a discussion of the Eleusinian mysteries. Now, the mysteries of Demeter and her daughter Persephone were held at Eleusis in Greece for almost 2,000 years. Now, these mysteries had the goal of providing a first-hand experience of the certainty and the continuity of life after death. The mysteries were established around 1450 before this common era, and 2450 before this common era, and ended only when the Roman Christian Emperor Theodosius I forcibly closed them down in 392 of the common era. And they were centered around the myth of Demeter, the Earth Mother Goddess, and her daughter Persephone. And in this story, Persephone was abducted by Pluto and taken to the underworld, and eventually was able to return. Now, this myth provided a key to giving real revelations to the population of that world. Thousands of people journeyed to Eleusis each fall to experience the Eleusinian mysteries, which means that hundreds of thousands were initiated. However, so tight was the secrecy, or so inexpressible was the experience, that no one has ever revealed its profound secrets. Now, tonight we will explore what is known, what is conjectured, and how Feriferia honors the Eleusinian experience. So, tune in and peek behind the veil of death. Now, before Lady Jo Carson calls in, let me say that I want you to hold your call-ins until after your questions, until after she finishes her lecture. That's the proper thing to do with a college professor or with a guest speaker who's an authority on a subject. That's the proper thing to do. And the call-in, though, when she's finished, if you want to call in, and please keep your questions on topic, and keep them on topic and apropos to the discussion. Our host, our guest call-in number is 347-857-1830. Now, I'll repeat that, 347-857-1830. But if you call in during the lecture, we'll just have to put you on hold. Now let me talk a little bit about Joe and Feriferia before she calls in. Feriferia, it means, the name Feriferia means celebration of sacred wilderness, and it was established by Frederick Adams, and Svetlana Buterin, his consort, back in 1968, and as a unique neo-pagan goddess-centered worship of nature, and in its pristine form and paradisial vision, and it draws its inspiration from Robert Graves' The White Goddess and Robert Graves' work. And from several other works dealing with the sacredness of nature and the entire beautiful contributions of classical paganism. And one thing I want to say about Farfaria that you should understand from right from the beginning is that Farfaria was and is, because it's still going, elegant. Now, it came up during the psychedelic era, and so there was a number of what you would call, what we call now the hippies, that really resonated with it because it was very, very much of a nature celebration, and it was very beautiful and poetic and artistic. But Farfaria was several cuts above the popular culture version of flower power. And it was both Fred Adams and Svetlana were both very, very cultured, people. I mean, they were truly, truly to the manner born, and their expression of this Farfarian vision that Fred had and that Svetlana very much contributed to, that their expression of it was elegant and lyrical and poetic and artistic. And Fred was a magnificent artist. He'd been referred to as the American William. And Svetlana had a beautiful singing voice, and she was, Svetlana was a better writer than Fred. So Farfaria's surviving rituals are really to her credit. Their ceremonies, quite frankly, their seasonal ceremonies, the nine royal passions of the year, which is, by the way, a portfolio of sacred art which we published, the Church of Hermetic Sciences published, and you can get on Amazon, by the way, and I just sent off a few copies to Amazon the other day. That's Nine Royal Passions of the Year, and that's Fred Adams' iconic art for each of the seasons. This beautiful booklet that Joe has put together, this Celebrate Wilderness, Magic, Mirth, and Love on the Farfarian Path, we have gone through several preliminary copies of that, and I have a couple of them. They're just absolutely beautiful, and she's going to, you know, make us aware of how we can get a hold of a copy of that book tonight. So be sure and have your pencils ready when she gives you the information. That's a beautiful, beautiful book. And also, too, I might mention that that in our Seventh Rays, our journal, which most of you regulars are familiar with, our Seventh Ray journal, both the book one, that's the blue ray, and book two, that's the red ray, and book three, which of the Seventh Ray, which are also available on Amazon, feature articles by Svetlana and by Fred. And, of course, the third one, Fred's passed away in 1980, and Svetlana passed away a year after Fred. And so our third Seventh Ray, the green ray, has the requiem for Fred and a description of Farfaria. So you can actually see some of their writings and artwork in our Seventh Ray journal. And yet the nine royal passions of the year, and that's our CHS's contribution to Farfarian publishing, and that came out way back in 1969, first issue of it. So, the Eleusinian Mysteries, as we said in the abstract, they began around 450 BC, and this means that they certainly were influenced by the Orphic cosmology, which also influenced the Gnostics and the Initiatic Code and whatever. And yet, no one really knows what it was that the initiates experienced, and there have been a number of speculations about that. And we should have Joe calling in just about any time now. And so, here she is. Joe, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good evening.
Oh, wonderful. I'm just about to run out here. And anyway, here is Lady Jo Carson, and we are very anxious to have you proceed and tell us about the rights of abuses.
Well, thank you, Polk. It's a real pleasure to be on your show, and thank you for the opportunity to talk with you tonight. I'm excited about the Eleusinian Mysteries, and I find it's one of those rare passions. Every so often I'll find someone else who's really excited about it. It seems like they're kind of one of those esoteric, like a fine wine. You find occasionally somebody that cares, and if they care, they care a whole lot. And then almost everybody else is like, what are you talking about? Like, what are you talking about? So it is rare, but it's really exciting to me to be able to present it to people and to talk about it. And maybe some of your people that are listening will also be among those people who are passionate about it and who would love to call in and might have questions or comments. And I'd certainly like to hear from them. So
I ask them to hold their calls until you get finished, because
right.
I know you have a
right.
prepared presentation.
Why, thank you.
Okay.
I'm going to just say a few things just to kind of lay a little kind of chronology just so we kind of are all on the same turf here in terms of time. There was an agriculturally based cult in what eventually became Greece. It was way before what, you know, the amalgamation of peoples that got together and created what we call, you know, early or archaic Greece and then classical Greece. In about 1450 BC, a lot of the more aggressive elements that had come into Greece from the northeast went further across the sea over to Crete, and they invaded Crete. Crete was very vulnerable. They had a long and really beautiful civilization for several thousand years of peacetime, but they had a huge volcanic explosion of a nearby volcano on an island, which devastated, covered the island of Crete with layers and layers of ash and soot. So it was like a volcanic winter for Crete. And then they had a series of famines, and it's speculated that there was also tidal waves. So it devastated their fishing culture. It devastated their shipping. They had a beautiful culture, which really got flattened. So they were quite vulnerable when these Greeks came over there, starting around 1500, sort of in slow and more waves. These particular early proto-Greeks were aggressive and eventually took over completely. And, of course, we think of Crete as being a state of Greece at this time. It belongs to Greece. So they did lose their independence. What happened was there was a lot of interchange at that point, and people who had been in Crete, some of them just plain needed to escape for various reasons. And then some people who came from the mainland were influenced by Crete. So you had a large influx of people going from Crete to Greece, and they took their beliefs with them, which is fairly normal. So that was when the Minoan or Cretan beliefs came to the mainland and mixed with the agricultural format that was going on there already in terms of a sort of a mystery tradition of the life of the land. And that was really when the Eleusinian Mysteries started. Now, interestingly enough, as Polk pointed out, even from the very beginning, there was this tradition of absolute secrecy with the Eleusinian Mysteries. Nobody was willing to talk about it, or maybe they just plain couldn't. But at the same time, it was also written in a number of places that the same mysteries were celebrated openly and for all on Crete. So that's kind of one of those enigmas. If it was open for everybody, why don't we have a record of what it was? Well, it, to me, that pushes us in the direction of saying, well, maybe the reason it's so secret is because you literally couldn't talk about it. It was like beyond words. You had an experience, words failed you. I'll develop that thought later. At any rate, so those mysteries that were established there in around 1450 BC were centered around the myth on the story of Demeter losing her daughter. Her daughter was abducted on a field by Pluto, who came up from the underworld. He had planted a narcissus, a very beautiful flower. She was entranced by it. In her kind of moment of being entranced, he grabbed her up and took her down on his chariot into the underworld. The mother, Demeter, was heartbroken. She couldn't find her daughter. No one seemed to know what was going on. Finally, it turned out that the son had seen what had happened, and Hecate had heard the shrieks of the daughter. So Demeter was able to find these entities and find out from them what happened, and Hecate actually helped her out quite a bit in terms of, you know, clarifying exactly what had gone down. And she stayed with Demeter and sort of gave her some assistance here and there. And Demeter stopped eating, and she also stopped growing. And when I say growing, I'm saying this because Demeter is the matter of the world. Her name literally means that it's the physical matter of the world. So if she decides in her grief to stop growing, that pretty much means that all the other gods are not going to get their sacrifices, they're not going to get their worship, they're basically not going to be considered gods. And because of that, that was a big deal up on Mount Olympus. Zeus and all the other people up, gods up there, were alarmed because the people were starving and they weren't giving any worship and sacrifice. And so these gods got together and said, well, we've got to do something, which eventually meant that they sent Hermes down to Pluto in the underworld and to make some kind of a deal. We've got to get Persephone out of the underworld. And lo and behold, she did come up. Interestingly, while she was down there, she ate a debated number, but a small number of pomegranate seeds. And these pomegranate seeds, the fates decreed, since she had eaten mortal food, she would have to come back there periodically. And it turned out that she wound up coming back there once a year for either 3 months or 4 months or 6 months. And that this set up a precedent so that every time she went down there, her mother would grieve and things would stop growing, and then she would come back up and they would start growing again. So that's kind of the rudiment of the myth. And it sets up the cycle of the seasons where the earth, which is, you know, the mother, Demeter, has this seasonal change that we participate in as part of life. So I've done a lot of talking. Did you want to say anything there, Poke, or shall I continue?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So what you have there within that myth is a situation where people are going to, or I should say within the mysteries of Eleusis, the people are going to go to Eleusis every year and get initiated into this deep mystery. And it's like there are a lot of myths out there. We have, you know, a world surrounded by various myths, and all the, you know, indigenous people have their myths. But what does that mean in terms of a personal participatory experience? Well, for the people of Greece, and then eventually came throughout the Mediterranean, people could go there and get this initiation once a year if they qualified. It meant that they participated in feeling that they were actually one with Demeter. They experienced her grief. They fasted. They grieved, and they longed, and they searched for Persephone. And eventually, this much we do know, at some point they had a vision of actually seeing Persephone. Now, a lot of people have conjectured maybe there was some kind of a trick involved, you know, some sort of stage magic or a theatrical presentation where they actually thought they saw the real Persephone. But there's no records of any stage props ever having been bought, and there are a lot of written things that referred to Eleusis. So there's nothing that would indicate that they actually had a kind of a theatrical, you know, show. And also, the way that the experience has been described, it was never that people sat there and looked at something. It was always that they actually experienced something. In the myth, or I should say in the mysteries, there were things that were shown, and there were things that were said, and there were things that were done or enacted. And no one's willing to say exactly what any of those things are, but we know that something along those lines happened. There was another important element called, there was a basket and then there was a chest. And people would recite a line that had to do with, I have taken from the basket, I have done whatever it is, and they never say what it is they did, I have done something with the thing, and then I have put it into the chest. And that's an enigmatic set of statements. It's hard to say, well, what on earth could that mean? I would like to suggest that because the whole of the Eleusinian mysteries revolves around life, death, and rebirth, that they are in fact talking about their own souls, and that the basket is the basket that a baby would be in. the casket at the end is, of course, the grave, the tomb, or what you would go down in onto the earth if you were buried. And that what they do in the meantime refers to their life. I think that that's actually a symbolic statement about their soul. They've gone through this experience of life, and now they're doing it consciously instead of unconsciously. So that's just one little thought on that. The thing about the Eleusinian Mysteries is many, many books have been written about the Eleusinian Mysteries, and you can find a lot online also. And I think I want to go ahead and just jump right into one of the next aspects of it, which is a lot of what you find online, and actually a number of the books that people have written in the more recent years are specifically saying that the secret of the Eleusinian Mysteries was X, Y, or Z type of drug. This kind of conjecture was getting started as long ago as when Robert Graves wrote The White Goddess, and he conjectured that the people there had an experience that was internal, and that it was powerful because there was some kind of drug augmentation. It is known that while people were in the final big sort of temple called the Telesterion, that they would have a drink given to them, served out of the Kikion. A Kikion was a drink. It was written down in Homer what the ingredients were, which was barley, water, and crusted mint. And this is a very bland mixture. One would think that it wouldn't be particularly magical. It is apparently what, in the myth, Demeter asked for when she was offered wine by someone who was helping by taking care of her. She said, no, I will have nothing to do with that. She asked for this particular drink and drank it. So people drink that either in honor of her or because it's a symbol for something else that really was what they drank. It has been pointed out that the Greek names, each, if you take the names in sequence of the items that are the ingredients, it can spell out a kind of an abbreviated form of the word, like a mushroom, And so some people say that mushrooms, sacred mushrooms or divine mushrooms, were one of the ingredients in the drink that they partook of. Now, Robert Graves also mentioned that idea. Another idea that's very popular is, Albert Hoffman, Gordon Wasson, and Carl Ruck wrote a book called The Road to Eleusis, where they speculate that maybe it was mushrooms or maybe it was an LSD-like ergot from barley called claviceps, which is kind of a rusty fungus of barley. This could theoretically turn into an intoxicating drink. I guess Albert Hoffman has written fairly extensively about he made one attempt to brew up something from this particular substance, and he had a psychedelic, quasi-psychedelic experience. Unfortunately, no one's been able to actually duplicate that experience, including the other people that were involved in writing that book. So there's a real lack of foundation, since we have, on the one hand, the Eleusinian Mysteries, which lasted for 2,000 years, with literally hundreds of thousands of people successfully experiencing them, and then now we can't find any way to duplicate at least that particular version of why it might have worked. So it's an intriguing idea, but no, there's just no proof for it. Terence McKenna thinks that it was maybe the Amanita muscaria or the psilocybin mushrooms. So there's a lot of, you know, different ideas that have to do with, you know, a drug as, you know, a psychedelic drug as being involved. I'm kind of dying for you to just say a few words here because I know you've got just a lot to say in there, and I don't like to blather on too long.
Well, okay. I'll speculate a little bit. I know people who don't know very much about Amanita and they don't know how to use it have done a lot of speculating about how it figures in everything. One fellow has written a book just recently. I got a copy of it up at the City Lights bookstore in San Francisco about the Mithriatic. The sacred Mithriatic meal was Amanita. Well, I'm not sure because that doesn't seem. I would personally, much as I would like, you know, much as I like Amanita and all that, and as as much as it actually is, as you know, it certainly is the best candidate for Vedic Soma. It really is, but I don't see Amanita being it for any uses, because Amanita has some very specific characteristics, and none of those specific characteristics seem to be mentioned in any of the, So, and how much psilocybin are they going to be able to get to handle all those people?
Indeed.
Psilocybin, you know, is kind of capricious, and I don't know how much of it grows around Greece. So, we're into... Yeah, it's a good question. So, I'm wondering now. Recently, the Oracle of Delphi. Somebody's done a very significant research that there is a gas, a volcanic, thermal gas that comes up. Or could have come up through the crack in the under the tripod of the Oracle of Delphi, and that particular gas would cause the visionary state that she had. Now, I'm wondering, just based upon that same idea, and the guy that came up with that idea had a lot of good research behind him, and that's taken seriously. Now, I'm wondering if the Eleusis might have been a particular cave that had that gas in it, and then we look into the idea of how would this go on for thousands.
We have seen
years?
There's a big problem though with any of these entheogenic approaches, which is this: we have probably a million people that went through this experience, pregnant women, children,
yeah,
you name it, old people, frail people,
yeah,
and
yeah,
none of them, there was never a report of anybody having like seizures or psychoses or schizophrenia, any kind of after effects. See, now, the thing is, like you look at in our own history, we had a problem with a drug. It was thalidomide, right? Pregnant women took it. We figured out in about 15 years that it was absolutely anathema. We cannot have pregnant women taking that drug. I mean, it doesn't take long. This was 2,000 years. I think that if there was a drug involved, it could have had side effects, and we would have heard about it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm not arguing. I'm not saying that psychedelics are bad.
No, not at all.
It would please me, actually. It would please me if somebody proved that Amanita was what they were using. I think that was great. But, mm-hmm, knowing what we know, and I agree with you. I tend to think this. You know, James, he's not an anthropologist. If he was an anthropologist, he would have known better. But he came up, this fellow James came up with this book where he said, around about 500 BC, the whole Mediterranean area and the European race, we all went through some sort of a psychic change. And before that time, according to him,
the bicameral mind thing, right?
Yeah, and the bicameral mind thing, which as a cultural anthropologist, I think is ridiculous. And as a magician, I also think it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. He said, well, before then, people couldn't differentiate between what they were imagining and what or dreaming and what the gods were saying. Well, come on.
Well, let me just say one
however,
thing about that.
Let me finish. In this case, I'm going to cite James in reverse, and I'm going to say, back when the Eleusinian mysteries were going on, people were a great deal more. They were believers.
Mm-hmm.
They believed in this, and they believed in the inner voices, and they believed in the ritual. And now we're looking at it from a post enlightenment, and I hate that term enlightenment for that. For when people be strove so hard to become unspiritual, and they call it the Enlightenment. From a post-Enlightenment perspective, we're looking back on it, and we're thinking, my gosh, they must have had a drug. And I don't think they needed it. I think if the ritual was properly done and properly staged and all, they could have achieved it. What do you think?
Well, I think that I sort of agree with you, but at the same time, I think it's also fascinating when we remind ourselves words give us capabilities that we don't have if we don't have words. And just to support my little argument, I was recently listening to a presentation about it was about people who were born unable to hear, and they couldn't speak the language. There were some of them who stayed that way, and then some who were eventually able to learn sign language. The person that they were interviewing, and then another one, talked about what it was like before they had language, because they were alive in these cases for many, many years before they actually learned how to actually communicate with sign language, which was the first time they ever had any language at all. And one person said that it was joyful and peaceful. And the other person referred to it as the dark time, and they didn't want to talk about it because it was just so, it was very difficult for them. And these are both people that are perfectly capable of speaking with sophistication now, but there was a long period of decades in their lives when they really literally had no thoughts. They did not have words. And there was a description by one of the researchers of going into a room in Mexico. There was a large group of men who lived in this room, none of whom had language. And they were communicating with each other very, very slowly, sitting in a circle, by very carefully acting out an event that had happened to them and then reacting it, so that other people would finally get what they had experienced, and then they would move on to the next aspect of their experience and try to act that out. So I'm just saying that this was fascinating because it gave me an inkling of what it might have been like for people before we actually had, quote-unquote, language that allows us to think about thinking.
Let me say this about that. Remember, that was something Kennedy always used to say. Let me say this about that, and that gave him a chance to think what he was going to say. to put what you just said in perspective, here again, we have to look at this post-Enlightenment reductionalist. What they call scientific, it really isn't, but what was called the scientific view, and look at it for what it really is. Now, a good example of that is B.F. Skinner, who I thoroughly despise. B.F. Skinner, in his behavior mod, he actually had a large segment of the psychological profession, whatever that is, believing that everything that the baby learned was learned from stimulus and response, that there was nothing, that we weren't born with any kind of memories or inherited skills or anything like this, or any cognizance, all of this. And Skinner, being an arch reductionalist and of course an atheist and a reductionalist, he brought this all down to stimulus response. And this actually, this was where, you know, the stimulus, this Skinner type thinking was what was behind some of the brainwashing experiments that the Russians were doing, and then what they were pulling on our guys in Pax Palace in Korea, and what the CIA's MK Ultra was trying to do, to use psychedelic drug shock to control people, and actually, you know, you can't do it. They finally found out you couldn't. That the Manchurian Candidate was kind of a, you know, a Skinneristic fantasy. The reason why that happened was Noam Chomsky, who might be a bit of a left-winger himself, but still, Noam Chomsky proved, he's a great linguist, by the way, he proved that the human mind at birth is born with what Chomsky called a grammar machine. Mm-hmm. The human, a baby, if he's all by himself, and he'll make up a language, and he'll actually make up a language, especially if he has to communicate with another baby. This grammar machine will create languages. We realized this, of course, in our Enochian, Enochian language that Dee and Kelly channeled back during Elizabethan times. That was a result. That language was another proof of Noam Chomsky's grammar machine, because Kelly, Dee knew Hebrew, he knew Latin, and he knew Greek, but Kelly didn't. Kelly didn't even have good Latin, and so when the angel started talking to him, he created his own language. Well, he created their own language, used his own grammar machine, and this is the case. We argued in anthropology about the analogy of Tarzan's box. Would Tarzan really be able to educate himself with this homeschooling box, this trunk that his parents had brought over to train to raise him in India, and he's shipwrecked on the western coast of Africa, and he gets adopted by the apes, but he keeps sneaking back to the old cabin and dipping into the box, and he educates himself from all these school books and primers that were in the box. And actually, according to Chomsky's theory, and yes, he could.
Hmm.
So we are born with a great deal more in our heads than these reductionalists and these so-called scientists.
I certainly agree with you on that.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of noticing that time's going by, and I do have a lot of more kind of details I'd like to communicate here about this, specifically the Eleusinian mysteries.
I thought you were asking me to fill in some time here.
Joe,
we have 2 hours, so just go ahead and finish up.
Okay.
I won't interrupt you.
All right. So you're welcome to say whatever you want, but I would like to just go back to the actual experience of the Eleusinian mysteries for those people who have participated. Anybody could go to be a participant if they spoke the language of Greek and they had not murdered anybody. The only exception that was made to that was when Hercules, who in fact had murdered plenty of people in the process of being quite the warrior, he had to receive special purification. And when they set that up to accommodate him, that was the beginning of when they started doing the two-part ritual. So they had one in the spring at a city or town called Agrai, A-G-R-A-I, which was southeast of Athens. And then people would go there for their initial spring experience. And then in September, approximately August to September, in the dark of the moon, they would start the 9-day Eleusinian Mysteries experience. Whole event would start out with messengers going out around the countryside and announcing that it was going to begin so that everybody knew to gather up their things that wanted to go. There were some costs involved. They had to pay the priests, and they had to pay for the cost of the pig that was going to be sacrificed. Each person had to bring a small pig to sacrifice because it was considered a very pure thing. And they would have this experience of getting together by the sea and bathing together and then sacrificing their pig, spending the night there in the Athens area, and then the next morning starting off to go to these 15-mile journey to Eleusis, which they walked the whole distance. There was a bridge partway along where, up until that point, people who were rich or maybe old, they could go in a carriage. But at that point, everybody had to get off of their carriages and walk together, forming a kind of a democracy and commonality among the people so that there wasn't levels of, say, the rich and the poor. Also, each person was wearing a same garment. It was kind of determined at some point that to participate you had to have a certain very plain, simple garment and wear that for this experience. Again, it took away the sense of differences among people and probably allowed people to have a lot more sense of commonality and communion and kind of fun with each other without feeling put off by maybe their neighbor being obviously a very different social class than themselves. Along the way, they had there was a lot of kind of joy and noise, people would sing and so on, but there was some interesting events that were set up along the way. One was they would cross this one bridge, and there were people that were set up to call names out against the rich people, especially the very powerful people. They would be taunted in a very negative way. And again, it was to kind of any puffed up ego that a person might have, this was to kind of take them down and go, okay, you know, you're the same as everybody else on this particular journey, which probably was part of the whole set and setting thing, getting people into the right mindset so that they would really be ready when they experienced the ultimate mysteries. Because I think most people could appreciate that if you go in with a big ego, it's just not going to be the same. It's kind of like Jesus saying, you know, unless you become as a child, you're really not going to gain the kingdom of heaven. You have to have that beginner's mind, that open, clean slate mind that's willing to actually be opened up. That isn't going to happen if you're so busy being full of yourself. So there were some other interesting events along the way, and it's a long, you know, 14 miles is a long way to walk. They did it all in one day. There was a vision. I don't know if it happened every single year. There was a particular female who would show up. She was incredibly beautiful, and she would come up out of the ocean, and because they were walking along a lot of us near the water, and she would come up out of the water, and people would kind of go, oh, she's just this radiant beauty. And now, nobody has explained to me why this was part of the mysteries, but this did happen, and or at least it's supposed to have happened. If someone is interested in really reading kind of a day-by-day account, Fred Adams did write a really beautiful day-by-day account of the Eleusinian Mysteries from a participant's point of view, and that's you can read that on the Farifaria website, farifaria.org. Go to the knowledge, after you go to the homepage, you go to the knowledge category, and then under life, death, and rebirth, there's three articles about the Eleusinian Mysteries, and this one that describes it that I'm describing to you right now is called Our Ecstatic Journey. You might feel like reading that after this radio show is over, and then you'll feel like you've really got the, you know, the really intimate description of every detail. Which I can't relay all to right now. It's quite a long article. Anyway, so they would get there to this outer perimeter of the Eleusinian temple complex, which I've been to, actually. I went there a number of years ago as part of shooting my film, Dancing with Gaia. And it's all in ruins. There's barely one, you know, of the carved stones on top of another one. There's just a few bits of a few of the entranceway areas that are still a little bit piled up. But things have labels on them, and you can make your way along the Sacred Way, which was the name of the road they took from Athens. And, you know, one could theoretically make the same journey. It used to be a very beautiful journey because the fields near there were the most fertile fields in all of Greece, the Rarian Plain, I think it's called. And there was, in fact, a lot of barley growing there. People would enter the temple precinct, and then one thing they did was they stayed up all night and they danced, though they'd made this terribly long journey. They danced around this well called the Well of Beautiful Dances, and it's my theory, having kind of thought about that well and the fact that they were already, you know, kind of tired and exhausted and probably very hungry, and, you know, according to one of the amazing, wonderful researchers, is Carl Kerenyi, he's written many books on Eleusis. He said that they fasted the whole time. Other people say they only fasted on certain days, so there's not an agreement on that. But still, they may have been fasting, and so they would have been in a heightened state of awareness and expectation. And then they are dancing pretty much almost all the whole night around this circular well, which is going to be reflecting, right? You're going to look at the water, and you're going to see, because it's the dark of the moon, you're going to see the stars reflected in the well. and people were also carrying torches as they danced. So you get this amazingly visual panoply of stars above your head, and the reflections of the stars in the waters, and then the moving torches all around you of the people as they danced in the circle dance. And I can only imagine that this was spectacularly beautiful and a very visionary experience in and of itself, and very powerful in terms of getting people further along that inner journey towards being really ready to receive the final mysteries. So the days had gone by. People did stay with somebody one of the nights there at the in the Eleusis area. They slept eventually, but as you know, time goes by, there's some sacrifices and preparation, and then they go over as a group to the cave of Pluto. Again, I saw this cave. It's not a terribly deep cave. I think that possibly it either crumbled and fell in, or when it was a temple was destroyed by the forces of, well, Christianity, the Theodosius the First, who was a Roman emperor, Christian, purportedly emperor, as part of destroying basically all pagan temples and monuments, ordered for the Eleusinian Mysteries to be closed in about 393 or 4 A.D., and then just a couple of years later, the forces of Alaric the Goth, he was king of Goth, came down and literally destroyed the temples and took every stone down. So at any rate, back to the Plutonian cave, what you see is not very deep. It's not something you can go deeply walking into and find yourself in a room. It's sort of shallow. But I suspect that at one time it was quite a bit deeper, and maybe it did have some kind of a gas in it, although I just don't know, because there was never, like I say, a report of any kind of side effects, what we would call drug side effects. But in Fred's beautiful description, which based on a lot of research, I have a page and a half of his bibliography of the Eleusinian Mysteries, which I will retype and post. I haven't got a digitized copy of it yet. On the website, people can see what the books were that he referred to do his research on this. But he wrote that people, while they were there at the Plutonian cave, was where they experienced seeing Persephone. And other people think they saw Persephone in the Telestarian, so I'm not sure why there's disagreement. But there was a vision which Fred describes as having been searching in sad and grief-stricken along with Demeter and identifying with Demeter. Then they get to the cave, and then that Persephone, first they see it looks like a hag, like a death, a corpse coming up, because she had been in the world of the dead. But then that just floats away, all that hag-like appearance, as if it's in smoke. And there's the radiant Persephone, just in all of her gorgeous young beauty. And everybody is so thrilled to see her, identifying as they are with Demeter. They feel the same emotional response that Demeter would have felt, which would be incredibly joyful and grateful to see her daughter. So the next, I think, day, and I'm not getting my sequence exactly 100% right in terms of exactly how many days were spent doing what here, but the final event there for the most of the people was then going into the building called the Telestarian, which was large enough to accommodate up to 3,000 people, when that's, in fact, how many people were doing this for many years in a row. It's a huge, huge crowd, and I can only imagine they had a lot of support services. But they went in there, and it was dark in there, and so they had torches. They had a central, very small room, which had a door in it, which was not in the – it was, I say central, it was in the middle, but it was actually off-center of the middle. It didn't face the crowd, and there was no amphitheater-type seating in terms of where people could see that the opening to that small, tiny building within the building. The Hierophant, whose name meant the shower, he was the one who was going to open the door to that at some point. This is known. There is, you can still see them, I saw them, little steps, one upon the other, all around the edges of the room, which everybody could actually sit down. There were columns very closely spaced to either hold up the ceiling or to replicate trees. I don't really know. But what that would have done, it would have prevented the crowd from seeing, like, any kind of a show in this theatrical sense. If somebody was trying to present, like, some kind of a little drama, it was absolutely inappropriate because they couldn't possibly have seen it around all these large columns that were there everywhere. And also the direction that this little tiny building within a building faced, it wasn't even towards the main, where the majority of the people would have been either seated or standing. So there's a lot of kind of oddness around this. Nonetheless, people were in there, and people said what they said. They saw certain things, they heard certain things, and they enacted certain things. And they took the drink of the Kikian with its mysterious ingredients, which I have said what we know they were, and they might possibly have included something additional, that would have enhanced the experience in a safe way. And I'm not throwing that possibility out by any means. There was so much going on in that era of the world with people mixing up, like wine, for instance, was never just what we think of, the product of fermented grape, period. It was a concoction that had a lot of other things in it, not just grape juice that was fermented. People were constantly brewing up things that were relatively exotic. They knew how to do it. A lot of people were specialists in it. And it's fairly fascinating if you read up on it. I've got some wonderful books on sacred brewing and herbal healing, which kind of gave me a little education in terms of how much was really known. And unfortunately, we've also lost probably more knowledge than we actually have now about what was going on then. So it is quite possible that they had some really, really safe thing that they could give people that would enhance their experience, but not replace the experience. I think enhance is probably more accurate. One of the fascinating things that was reported was that in the whole, 2,000 years period, which is a very, very long time of how long these mysteries were enacted, there was one time only when some strangers got in there and lived to tell the story. Two young men somehow managed to get into the temple area, and they got themselves physically inside of the telesterion. And then they were discovered as being imposters. They weren't, initiates. They weren't people who had gone through all the pre-initiatory process, and they were kicked out. I think that one of them was killed. I'm not sure if the other one was killed or just managed to escape with his life. But nonetheless, he was able to communicate to other people outside of the mysteries that he had, in fact, they had actually seen something, and what they had seen, interpret this how you will, that the building was full of the gods floating in every direction. The gods were there floating in the air in every direction. How can we interpret that? It's such a fascinating
That sounds like a medieval magic lantern show.
Maybe.
And actually, the truth of the matter is that was possible. They recently discovered in Japan, and I'm trying to get a hold of one, a reflective magic mirror that comes from, I don't know, thousands of years back, came over from Tibet into Japan. And this, what you do is you take this mirror, and it has carvings on it, very delicate carvings, and you reflect that sunlight that comes through a shaft, and that reflects into smoke and produces these visions. So this is a variation of, that sounds like it could have been. And Paracelsus and others in the late Middle Ages and early Renaissance, they had what's called the magic lantern, and basically that was a transparency with a light behind it. And you could reflect like a slideshow. You could reflect it on a surface or in smoke.
Well, does that require a lens?
Yeah, well, the transparency itself would be the lens in that sense. And I don't know whether you've seen the latest Oz movie, but the climax of the latest of the great and powerful Wizard of Oz is using that sort of a medieval magic lantern on a huge bonfire of smoke in the middle of the city square. But yeah, this is possible that was the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think that is possible, and I don't know, but It's a cool idea. I like it. They haven't found anything like that, but very well it could have been destroyed either on purpose when the decree came out that they had to close the Eleusinian Mysteries. The two principal families who kept, they were the, there was the Hierophant's families, there was the Eumolpids and the Kariikis, I think it was. These two families were the ones that basically administered and were in charge of the mysteries. And every, you know, when they had their sons and daughters, they took over and so on. So that went down for like, you know, that whole period of time, apparently 2,000 of years. And they might have taken it upon themselves to destroy any paraphernalia because nothing was ever found, you know, in terms of apparatus like that. But again, they might have just said, you know, we can't let this get out. You know, this secret has to go away now, and maybe it'll be discovered again sometime, but not now, you know, because they didn't want to have these terribly destructive people come down and destroy, you know, to take their secrets away as well as actually destroy their temple would have been insult upon injury. The thing that, you know, I want to come back to the sort of touchstone of our show, which is that a number, like everybody who was anybody, was initiated into these Eleusinian mysteries. Not just the early Greek era, what they call the Archaic era, also in the Classical Greek era, and also in the Greek-Roman era, where Rome was actually, you know, coming into power and then in full power up until the Roman edicts started coming out that only Christianity would be allowed to be a religion, which was right around 360 A.D. Until then, Eleusis was very, very powerful, and it was an incredible magnet. People went there from all over the Mediterranean. As Christianity's forces got more and more determined to have one and only one religion in that whole area, at a certain point people realized that they basically, it was politically incorrect to be involved, and so the less people started going, of course. But at any rate, the focus and all these people who, you know, experienced it, they were allowed to talk about how they felt. They just couldn't talk about what happened. And what they did record was that as a result of experiencing this, they no longer were afraid of death. And that's so profound. I mean, what does it take for people to not be afraid of death, especially consistently? Like, all of the people said this. And they said that as a result of having this blessing of this experience of initiation, they live a happier life now, and they have an expectation of a happier life after death. So there are some things that I would like to put forth as to how Farfaria views the Eleusinian Mysteries and what happened there. Specifically, Persephone is, Kori is the name, means daughter goddess or the young maiden goddess, and she's the central divinity for Farfaria, because we feel that etymologically Kor and care are very similar words. They are etymologically very related, and I want to mention as a background that there's being a continuous movement forward with humanity from the very, very raw beginnings before we were even really human, and more and more and more as time goes on now, even with the internet, there's an increasing amount of caring that's going on between people, and between people, and between people caring for other beings like animals and places. And in the early, you know, earliest parts of humanity, maybe we had an easier life and things were sort of paradisal, but we certainly have gone through periods of just incredible bloodshed. And even now there's a lot of, you know, painful wars going on around the world. However, according to a University of, I think it was Toronto, study in 2006, I believe it was, actually the amount of worldwide violence has been consistently going down year after year with variations, you know, here and there, but still, if you look at the broad swath of history, there's less violence. And as we get more and more connected to each other, the increasing amount of care goes up. And I think that this is intrinsic to our souls as human. This is kind of what we're here to do, is to increase the amount of loving and caring that's going on between people and for the planet. And I think that if we are going to survive as a human, as humans, and having an Earth to live on, that's absolutely crucial, and this is the transformative step we have to take. So to take that back to Cori, right, the young maiden goddess who cares, Persephone was an emanation of that maiden goddess, and she was the sweet young daughter of Demeter. She went down into the underworld in her loving, sweet, gentle nature, in her beauty, in her magnificence, and Pluto, of course, had selected her ahead of time. I mean, he knew that she was beautiful. He knew that he wanted to make her his bride. He had gotten permission from Zeus, his brother. Pluto was also, you know, an Olympian god, but he was down below. Zeus had gotten the Olympus, and he had gotten the underworld, but it wasn't considered a bad place. It was considered the seedbed, or the place for the seeds and all the riches to come from. That was the underworld. So he had gotten Persephone down there, and what he didn't know and what nobody really expected to happen happened, and that was that Persephone forever changed the nature of the underworld. She brought love to the underworld. And she because of who and what she was, she brought that Olympian sort of strain of immortality, you know, that fine sensibility, she brought it down into the underworld in such a way that Pluto no longer would just have people die and stay dead. It was like she was going to be allowed to be returning to the upper world because of the deal that was made, and her what she did when she was there with being so loving was that she changed Pluto's approach so that then he would allow not only her but also all of humanity the chance for rebirth. And that's the perspective that Farfaria has about Persephone. And Fred, he got this from a lot of study. I think that Carl Kerenyi's book that he wrote with Carl Jung, C.G. Jung, the great psychiatrist, psychologist, and Carl Kerenyi wrote this book called, Archetypal Mother and Daughter. Let's see, The Miracle of Eleusis. Hold on, it's one of these. Here we are. Eleusis, Archetypal Image of Mother and Daughter, a Bullington series, volume 4, published 1967. It's a wonderful book. I've read actually a lot of these books, but it's probably the best. And with the influence of Carl Jung being involved, it's, am I telling stories here? I think that's the one, at least, that Jung was involved with. They co-wrote a book about this, and the psychological aspect of it is what I'm trying to get at here. It was that this is a transformation that happened at what Pope calls often the inner, not the shared reality, but the interpersonal reality, that one has this possibility of renewal, and it's both objectively true in shared reality, but it's also crucially important that it's true within your own personal reality for it to actually take place. You have to actually have a certainty, and then you know it's not going to just magically happen if you have no consciousness whatsoever. If you have a consciousness, then you are going to be more likely to receive this gift, and that's why the people who had gone to the Eleusinian Mysteries, blessed is he who has experienced these mysteries, they don't have nothing to fear. But the person who has not experienced the Eleusinian Mysteries, it doesn't have this great blessing. So it was definitely understood that there was a dichotomy between the people who had that consciousness and the one who didn't. Did you want to say anything, Polk? I just have a feeling you probably do.
Well, I did want to say something a little while back, but I forgot what it was. But you're doing fine. The whole idea of Pluto being converted, more or less, or saved. Persephone saving Pluto, so he releases the souls to return. This is wonderful because the Greek hell or Hades was really a gloomy place. I mean, it has come down to us. The Roman Catholic Church, you know, in Dante, they adopted aspects of that for purgatory and what have you. But I remember Achilles, that line from when Achilles, and they summon up the shade of Achilles, and he says, I'd rather be a beggar in the land of the living than a prince in the land of the dead. Remember?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is very significant, I think, as Persephone and Corey is there as the Redeemer, that allows us to have more pleasant reincarnations.
Absolutely.
I guess that's wonderful, and that of course is probably the reason why. I would think, just thinking about what you're saying, this is probably the reason why the Eleusinian Mysteries lasted so long and why everybody enjoyed them so much, is, in a sense, they were giving the people the same thing that in a way that Jesus was giving the people. The reason why Christianity was so successful was because Jesus was just enthusiastically promising everybody that all they had to do was follow his teachings, and they would have a glorious life in the next world. And that was not something that, well, the Gnostics were preaching something like that, but not as enthusiastically and as simply as Jesus was. And if this is what the Eleusinian Mysteries were offering to people who only thought of a gloomy afterlife, you know, that, yeah, this was one of the reasons why it lasted so long.
Mm-hmm.
Here is the glowing light of salvation in the middle of this world where all you have to look forward to is a gloomy life, and well, we're gonna. You come here, and you'll learn that the next life is going to be just as good as can possibly be. I think that may be the treasure that kept it going for so long. What do you think?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think that it was obviously an incredibly transformative experience, because it was just. People wrote about it with such incredible reverence, and it was highly respected. The only time there was one person who, you see, this sort of agitates for the idea that there was a substance involved. This one noble Greek man was accused of having obtained the Eleusinian Mysteries and served it to his dinner guests. Well, how can you... You know, it really makes it sound like it's just a substance, you know. And yet, at the same time, I wonder about that, because this particular individual was he was intelligent. He was a very shady character in the sense that he was very sarcastic. He had a negative view of everything. He didn't believe in anything, did not believe in the gods, any of them. And at a certain point, he was run out of town, and... it was for disrespect for the gods, I believe. Of course, there was the Eleusinian thing, too. But he left, and I think he went to, it was Persia, might have been early, yeah, Persia. And he would be like a military commander for them, and then he eventually got somebody to invite him back to Greece, and they let him back because he was so handy to have in a war, and he could strategize very, very well. But... again, the thing I just wonder about anything that was said about him, because he was like a very negative thinker, and anything around him, it's like he would make up the worst possible spin and make it sound minimal. He liked to put things down, including the Eleusinian Mysteries or anything, and he put down all the gods as well. So you will hear that story about him, but at least that's my take on it, having read about him, is that I think there might have been a substance involved, but that's certainly not the whole thing. That's just a small part of it. So I think they provided something incredibly powerful.
I do think, though, that we should remember, in looking back on this sort of thing, that this was an age all the way up to this, what we call the Enlightenment. People believed. I mean, they did. They believed There weren't that many atheists running around. There were a few in Greece, of course, a few, because the Greeks speculated on everything, obviously. So there were a few cynical philosophers, but even Plato, with all of his political chauvinism and pragmatism and everything, he insisted on the veneration of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And Socrates did too. And all of these, the major Greek philosophers, the reverence for the gods was just assumed. I mean, you just did. And I think that we're looking back on this from this post-Enlightenment perspective and wondering just what it was that really was. And we just failed to realize that in those days, people really took religion seriously. They did. And they do it, and we don't today. Are you still there?
Well, I'm not sure that we don't. We do.
We do. We realize. In fact, I tell some of my students who are cynical type people, I say, look, religion, whether you like it or not, religion is a tool. And if you look at it as a tool, and so believe it if it's useful to you. And if you find that later that it's not useful, then believe something else. But it's a tool. But believe.
Yeah.
You know, while you're doing it.
I just wanted to mention that earlier in the show I said that it's possible that people didn't talk about it because they literally couldn't come up with the right words. It's like there weren't words to describe what happened. And I think the reason I personally think that's got to be true is because I actually had an experience myself, absolutely without drugs. It was one of those, like, I didn't do anything special to get it. I was just lucky. And it was, you know, I was like, I would have think, well, I was asleep, but I wasn't asleep. I was some, and it wasn't a dream. I was in bed, but I had this experience that's absolutely beyond words, and I wish I could repeat it. It was an amazing experience. All I can say is the way I described it later to people was the laughter of the gods. I was, you know, my consciousness was somewhere either else or it was expanded. It was way more than everyday consciousness. There was a sense somehow of gods, like divinities, plural, definitely, and of joy and of laughter, and that was somehow the essential nature of reality. That's what I got from it. And I don't talk about it too often because, boy, I'm having trouble describing it even now. And, you know, if people have had some kind of experience like that, they'll kind of get it. But I don't know. It seems like, you know, most people when I talk about it, it's kind of neat, but I didn't have that, you know.
Yeah. Well, having had a similar experience a couple times, so let me ask you this about it. Now, Walter Stace wrote a little book about the nature of this experience that we're talking about. He calls it undifferentiated unity. The way he describes it is the ultimate mystical experience is when you become one with the universe and one with God, and you feel like you are completely the center of everything, and you don't particularly know anything. It's just, and you don't have the. But it doesn't matter because you are the center, and you're at one with the whole universe, and you have this wonderful feeling of expansiveness and elation, and like you have reached the ultimate.
Well, I think that certainly describes my experience, except that there was also this feeling that there was I wasn't alone. I wasn't alone. There was this sense of laughter and these, like, not that I could see, like, individual divinities or anything, but somehow there was this sense that there were these others, you know, and that it was very joyful and there was sort of a sense of all of us or something about it. So, you know, I guess I'm fortunate because I discovered Farfari and Fred Svetlana were always insisting that there's no ontological necessity for there to only be one. they always were insisting that there was just as much of a likelihood and necessity for there to be many individuals as there to be one.
I agree. Now, my particular time, the times that I've had this experience, it is basically, I guess maybe I'm a monotheist probably at my inner nature, even though I very much, I very much believe in pantheism, because I think that monotheism gets misused all the time. So let me put it this way. I would have appreciated your mystical experience as much or more than my lonely one. My lonely wasn't lonely. I was at the center of everything, and how could I be lonely? I mean, everything was mine. But I didn't really feel like people were, like there were invisible beings around me laughing, although I wish I had. I envy you your pagan mystical experience. Next time I'm going to try for that. I think I want to try for the pagan
words,
mystical
words
experience.
Are very difficult. You know what I'm saying. It's like
we're sitting here trying our hardest
to describe something that can't be described,
I don't know. I was lying under a mirror. I was lying under the mirror and looking at a fire tatwa. All right, so that was when blammo, I had help in that from Bread Top, but boy, I'll tell you that was probably it. I was looking at this one fire tatwa. Now, maybe if I'd been looking at a group of things, maybe whatever. But these are mystical experiences. You want to take some callers?
Sure. If someone wants to call, I'd love to have them call.
Okay. Let's open up for the callers here, because we got plenty of time. So what's the number is? Those of you who'd like to talk with Joe about this, and you can even talk with me too if you want to, but. The guest call-in number is 347-857-1830. And we got a caller. Who are we speaking with? Hello? You're on the air. Who are we talking with? All right, we don't have anybody. Okay, well, anyway.
Well, maybe they can call back if they didn't quite get through.
they'll call back. Anyway. This mystical experience thing, this brings up, yours and mine, differing in the sense that I was having this,
I'm the one and only, the center of the universe, and it's all mine. And,
the funny thing about that was I really didn't care about finding out anything about it.
Right.
There was no desire
there's a sense of absolute completeness. You're absolutely right about that. You don't need anything else. It's all there.
That's it.
Do you have a moment? Can I say, are you there?
Go ahead.
Yeah. I want to, before we, kind of get too far down the road, because sometimes things kind of suddenly it's like, okay, we're all done, and then I might forget this important thing that I wanted to mention. I wanted to just mention that it's interesting that in Greece, even today, there are areas out in the countryside where people do agriculturally inspired festivals, I guess you'd call them, not exactly rituals, but they have a ritual component, and there is a Christian overlay, but there are kind of little bits, if you look at what they're doing, that seem to sort of harken back to the Eleusinian mysteries, just little bits of what they're doing. And in their weddings, like even today, they throw pomegranate seeds, and they include pomegranates as like an element of the fertility aspect of marriages. And it's like there are these sort of little bits of things that aren't completely lost, which is nice. Other things that are going on are that here in the U.S., I don't know the limit of how many different people are trying to simulate the Eleusinian mysteries, but Oberon Zell mentioned to me one time that he was involved with some people who were recreating the Eleusinian mysteries. Apparently they had been doing it every year as kind of an open, you know, just sign up for it and do it thing. But I think that he said they were changing it over so it would be like a year-long preparation format, much more involved before one would actually get to the final experience. Also at the Church of, not Church, I'm sorry, the, what is it, CIIS, Integral Studies, something Integral Studies. It's a college. I'm sorry. They have a program. It's in San Francisco, and Integral Studies. It'll come to me in a minute. They have a women's studies program there, women's spirituality specifically. Mara Keller is the name of the. I'm sure she's a PhD who runs that program, and she, I believe, is going to be writing a book or maybe has already written a book. She, last time I spoke with her, she was working on it, on the Eleusinian mysteries. She can be found also on the Internet. She's published a paper that she wrote on the subject a while ago. And she said to me that she and her students do some sort of a creation, recreation of the Eleusinian mysteries as part of their studies, which I thought was kind of an interesting thing to actually experience that on a university level. The name of her place, I just remembered, is California Institute for Integral Studies. And it's a really a fine university or college, I believe. So if other people know of other people who are doing versions of the Eleusinian mysteries, I'd love to hear about it. I believe that the one that Oberon Zell referred to does probably involve the use of some entheogens, I would guess.
There was a group here about 5 years ago or more. We had a group here in the Los Angeles area that made I think for 1 year they staged and they had some very very impressive promotion on it. It was rather expensive and whatever. And they tried to do it. I think they did actually do one season of it. And then we never heard of them after that. So if they're still doing it, they're doing it very quietly.
That was
going on, and they called it the Eleusinian Mysteries, and you had to go through quite a process to sign up for it or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think Greg, I shouldn't be mentioning names, but one of our people, I think, went through it, and I could find out from him what went on. But I haven't heard from them in years, though. So I don't think anybody in this area is doing it. I may be wrong.
Yeah. Oh, of course, Farifaria, we have our initiation, which has certain elements that we've sort of appropriated from the Eleusinian Mysteries. So, without
we did that down here, yeah.
But, yeah, we certainly have that within Farifaria also.
So, anyway, I want to mention your book, and I want to try to see if we can get some copies of your book out there. Also, tell us about your book, and tell us how to get it.
Celebrate Wildness, Magic, Mirth, and Love on the Farifaria Path is with art by me, but with art by Fred Adams. Is really, it's a lovely what you would call an art book. It's printed on very thick black paper, very heavy. It's a hardback book. Almost every single page has very large paintings and drawings and illustrations by Fred Adams. Really, really beautiful. I did the photography that's in there with a few exceptions. A few by Zandria has actually contributed a few photos. Thank you very much. And the book is, the first section of it is, it's almost an initiatory experience in and of itself because it's visions. On one page you'll get one of the visions that Fred created, and then on the page facing it you'll have the teaching or the meditation, you might say, that goes with that vision. And so, you can kind of ponder through that for, you know, the first quarter of the book or so. It talks about what Fairy is and what Kori is, the heart of the world, and there's lots of visions of the goddess and what Kouros is and the twin goddesses, the light and dark aspects of the goddess, the relationship between breasts and fruit trees, the mysteries of death and rebirth, and uses of trance and magic of dreams, a meditation for going deep down into the earth for regeneration and blessing. Then the next section is called Fairy Practices. It describes the whole role of the fairy in Fairy, and how to make a fairy ring henge and how to bless it and consecrate it and use it and have fun with it, and how it connects to the seasons and the sacred directions and how you can get wilder charms and all that and get those involved with your circle and kind of expand the meaning and connection of your circle way out to the horizon and beyond. There's imagery that goes with the sacred year. There's a whole discussion of what we were talking about of Eleusis and Eleusinian mysteries. There's a sample of like a fairy ring practice or a fairy ring circle that you might do on your own. There's a self-dedication that you can do if you wish to on your own kind of join with Fairy in your heart. Some more about the biomes and the ancestors and the fairies and how it all fits together. So that's kind of a little, I guess, word picture to describe what is in this book. And it's not a cheap book. I have to admit it's kind of an expensive book because of what it is. It's like I say, it's an absolutely gorgeous, really, you know, beautiful, thick, heavy paper with gorgeous illustrations, and it's a hardback book, so it isn't inexpensive, but it does have a lot in it, and I hope that any of you who do order it, you know, I'm sure you'll really enjoy it. It's available through the Fairy website. That's literally the only place that's available in the world, and if you were on the Fairy website, fairyferia.org, you could just go to the tab at the top that says Tools, and then it says Books under that, and you click on that, and then you'll see Books and Texts for Sale, and it's the first one available on the top along with a picture of the book. So I think that kind of describes it pretty well, and I hope
you'll look into that. Give us the website again. Give us the website twice.
I'll spell it out.
For these people now. These people got to pick up. First, pick up your pencils, people out there. Go find your pencil, now pick it up, now get a piece of paper, and now Joe Carson will give you the website. Go ahead.
Okay. All right, so I'll spell it out, fairaferia.org, which is fairaferia.org. And once you're on the website, you'll see kind of towards the top of the page a series of little tabs. And you just go right over to the next to the last one over, which says Tools. Take your mouse down to where it says Books and then click on that. Ignore the little tabs off to the right. They're superfluous. Just click where it says Books, and that'll take you to where it says Books and Texts for Sale. And it's the first item on that page, you'll see, with a nice description and a picture of the book. So I think that's what you need to know.
And you will go to this website, and you will get this book. Because you want
glad.
It. And you will be
he
glad.
Says, this is not a
and you will be happy. And when you wake up, you will remember everything you have been instructed to do.
There's a little
buy
now button down there.
All right. Now,
you know, you
okay. And let's see. We're probably gotten this wrapped up.
Yeah.
So I will tell them about what's going on next week. And next week, for those of you who are still there, you hearty souls who still want to stay with this mystical program, next week we are going to go, and we've gotten up to the point now in the Tree of Life where we are just about getting close to the abyss. So what's going to happen here is next week we're going to Saturn, and we're going to be out of the 10-sphere tree, and we're going to be going into the 11-sphere tree.
Mm-hmm.
So this is when
if you're, you know, you can miss some of the others because, you know, everybody knows about the 10-sphere tree, but this is your chance to find out what lies at the edge of and into the abyss. And so don't miss next week's. That is, if you're, you know, if you're one of these abyss living people. So don't miss next week, and we'll be back here. It's same place. And thank you so much, Joe.
That was beautiful and informative, and it makes me really gets me excited about doing this. Or finding out finding the experience. Anyway, take care, be well, and good magic.
Good night.